You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Felicia C. Sullivan was forced to grow up too fast. She came from a poor single-parent home, and that single parent was her cocaine-addicted and controlling mother. When her mom disappeared, Felicia didn't go looking for her. Instead, she invented a past. That is, until she realized her real past was hard to leave behind. She's written a memoir called The Sky is Invisible from Here, published by Algonquin, and I'm pleased that it brings Felicia C. Sullivan to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Where in Brooklyn did you grow up?
I grew up in Borough Park.
And what was it like in those days?
Borough Park was really interesting because New Utrecht divided an area that was very Hasidic Jewish, 12th Avenue and 44th Street, which is where I lived predominantly. And then the other side of New Utrecht, you had an area of Black, Hispanics. So it was an interesting culturally mixed community.
How old were you when you began to realize that the other kids had different kinds of home lives than you did?
What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, how old were you when your mother started using cocaine?
I was 10. Our life was pretty nomadic until then. We moved quite a bit because she had many different men in her life. She raised me as a single parent. And
did you have any idea who your father was?
No. She was really upset that he left soon after he found out that she was pregnant. So the idea was, if he left, why should he take any part in my daughter's life? And it was an interesting upbringing because, you know, her sister was a heroin addict and she pretty much was a parent to her sister. So, you know, a year later, there she is kind of addicted to cocaine. So it was quite a jump in the course of a year.
But many years later, you wound up having a coke and alcohol problem. Mm-hmm. And you'd think that people who went through this, your mother and then you, would be the last ones because you've seen just how destructive it can be.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I've been thinking about that, especially now that I'm celebrating a year of sobriety from alcohol and almost six from drugs. And I think it's, you know, the easiest way to speak to that is to say, you know, my mom and I thought we were stronger. We, both of us, endured really difficult childhoods, and no way was something like cocaine going to stand in the way of our success. And so we thought we were much more powerful than that. And that's what sort of buys you some time, not dealing with your pain. I think the longer answer is I needed to understand how my mother could essentially consistently pick cocaine over taking care of her child. I needed to understand how she made those choices. And unfortunately, I think only after understanding addiction by being an addict, you really understand that the choice is always the drug over anything else.
Mm. Well, you were 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that she, like most people in that situation, tried to hide the fact that she was doing this thing from you.
Absolutely.
How long were you unaware of what was going on?
You know, when you're 10, you're forced, you're a child. And I was sort of forced to grow up quickly because all of a sudden these strange men would come to my house, you know, asking for money, you know, passing glassine bags. So I sort of knew that this was going on, but I wasn't really aware of how horrible it was probably until my middle to late teens.
You had to call cabs to take your mother, who was close to an overdose, mm-hmm. to the hospital. And then you'd sit in the waiting room until she was released.
And she'd blame it on smoking. She'd say, those damn cigarettes, you know, they're making me go to the hospital again. But, you know, who goes to the hospital just from smoking Kent 100s?
So what did you think was going on? You must have suspected it was something else.
I did.
At least at first.
I just didn't want to believe it because we had lived through watching my aunt overdose on heroin and consistently. And I couldn't even fathom the idea that here we were yet again going through the same thing.
Wasn't there at least one adult who could have taken care of those responsibilities, like taking her to the hospital? What about other family members?
She excised pretty much everyone else in our family. She had a really difficult relationship with her mother, and the great bulk of her brothers and sisters essentially sided with her mother. My mother was a very difficult person to know, so she pretty much alienated everyone in her life. So
it was a bit of narcissism on top of all the other stuff.
And she was the eldest, and so she felt that she was always right. And in the relationship between her and her mother, she felt abused by her mother, as she often claimed, and no one else really saw this abuse, or so they told me. So they pretty much sided with my mother. I mean, with her mother.
How did your mother support the two of you?
She was a waitress. She had a lot of waitressing jobs. At one point, she got her certificate in food management, and she was working in a deli.
And that was an
manager.
Optimistic time?
Absolutely. I mean, we were like, she's making $400 a week. It's so exciting. And back then, that was, you know, so much money. And working in Manhattan, because Manhattan, for people who lived in Brooklyn, it could have been China, because, you know, we only lived in our neighborhood. So it was exciting. And it brought the possibility of, well, maybe our lives will change.
And what
unfortunately,
happened?
She routinely, because she made so much money and had so much power within her job, and she was so trusted, she started to steal money. Because from the safe and from registers, and ultimately she was fired from her job.
She also had a temper, and the kids who pulled your pigtails at school learned about that.
Everyone knew that you did not mess with Rosina Sullivan. She was, I mean, we're both very similar looking, and she was a very small, petite woman, but she was very, very powerful, and everyone in the neighborhood knew that.
So did the unconventional circumstances of your home life make it difficult for you to make friends? You might have been reluctant to say, hey, come over to my house.
It was, because for the longest time, my mother wanted me to be her best friend. And she didn't want me becoming friends with other people, because that possibly would have meant that she would have been found out, that the things that were going on in my home were not actually really normal for a child to go through.
And I think she was also dependent on you.
Absolutely. I mean, I pretty much was her caretaker since I was a child.
Were you afraid of her?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So here you're in this weird position. You are the parent to your mother, and at the same time, you're the child to your mother.
Absolutely. I mean, there isn't a day that I wasn't fearful of her rages, or of the fact that we would go through periods where she would just grant me the silent treatment for some kind of infraction that I've done to her, which I didn't even know what it was.
And that's why you've said love is not unconditional.
Absolutely.
There must have been other kids whose parents had problems with alcohol or drugs. Were you aware of them?
Yes, but when we grew up in Brooklyn, the mentality was that whatever happened in your family, you kept it within your family. You didn't really talk to people on the stoop about it. I mean, you knew that certain parents were having problems with drugs or someone was going to jail, but you kept that within your house. You didn't really bring your baggage to school with you. So I pretty much did the same thing. I kept it within the confines of my house.
Well, you talked about how your mother's drug problems then led to your having similar problems. Mm-hmm. What about relating to other people? Because the way your mother dealt with love was really screwed up.
You couldn't be more than accurate in that. I think my mother had these set of rules that she taught me from very, very young, which I spent the great portion of my life unlearning. You know, she had the famous rule of, you know, never let people see you cry, never be vulnerable, it's weakness, and you have to always portray strength. And so when you learn something like that from an early childhood, you build walls around yourself, and no one can get through because you couldn't let anyone see pain. And I think for the great portion of my life, not only was I operating from a level of shame that no one could find out where I'd come from and or who my mother was, I was also afraid of letting people know exactly how painful that upbringing was. So it made, you know, just simple friendships or even relationships that much more difficult.
I'm sure that since the book came out, people have told you that they had similar experiences.
Yes.
Did that make it any easier for you?
It does. It makes it really comforting. Because for the longest time, and I know this sounds sort of silly, you think to yourself, I'm alone in this. No one else understands what I'm going through. And since the book has come out, and even before then, when I was writing it, and I have a blog, and I was writing about my book, a lot of people would write me privately, talking to me about their lives and how they were made to feel shame because they have given up on their parent or, you know, wanted to have their parent out of their life. And it's a difficult decision to make, but I think one that sometimes is for the benefit of yourself.
My guest is Felicia C. Sullivan. Her memoir, The Sky Isn't Visible From Here, Scenes from a Life, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. When did you realize that you wanted to write?
You know, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was living a life that was perfect on paper. And I was working on a novel filled with very unlikable characters doing very boring things. And I think there came a point in my life, in conjunction with me being a drug addict and an alcoholic, where the weight of those two lives, one leading a very professional, acclaimed sort of life, and one being of a frightened child never having to mourn her mother, living both of those was very difficult to bear. And I had a conversation with one of my friends who had a similar sort of mother. Her mother was schizophrenic, and we talked about just the pattern of abuse and behavior. And I thought to myself, there are other people like me, and it's not shame.
What I meant actually is you were a kid, when you were a little kid, did you know you always wanted to be a writer?
Yes.
And
I
then
did.
when you started dealing with this material, which I'm sure was always there in the back of
sure.
your head and in everything, did you ever consider perhaps writing it as a novel? And because it must have been incredibly painful and also difficult to get all the facts right, because you say your mother lied to you. It probably
Absolutely.
Would have been easier just to invent some of this stuff.
I think for the longest while, I mean, I've always written about my mother in some form. She's always been my subject. And I did indeed write a novel when I was at Columbia, and it was a suburban family modeled pretty much, with the exception of the place, modeled on my family. And I really felt compelled I kept going back to the story as a memoir, as writing truth, because I think it is important for people to have shared experience as opposed to cloaking it around fiction.
And then I assume in researching it, you reconnected with some of the estranged family members.
I haven't actually. Because we were excised from them, I actually don't have a lot of my family's last names.
So then she left right before you graduated from mm-hmm. college. Do you have any idea of why?
We had a falling out. She had, about 8 months prior to our final conversation, she had left us for another man. And it was very difficult because she left the apartment in shambles and I had to, again, clean up after her and take care of everything. And we had a final phone conversation where this man that she was living with, who she thought she would have this great life with, tried to strangle her. And she wanted back in our lives. And at that point, I really had to make a decision. Either it's her or me, and I chose me. And I told her that. And she wasn't entirely thrilled with my decision. And she sort of bowed out of my life, and I haven't seen her since 96.
Not at all. Has she ever tried to get in touch with you?
No.
So you have no idea what she thinks about this book.
I don't even know if she's alive, actually, at this point.
But one of the other things you did, and I think it's probably understandable, is you try to distance yourself from your past.
Yes.
You actually reinvented yourself and mm-hmm. also modeled yourself on people you thought you should be more like?
I did. I think it was because the shame was that great from where I came from. And I assumed a lot of that shame because I was her parent, that I wanted to live a life completely opposite from the one that I had. So that meant following after, affluent WASPy friends, taking on their accent, the kinds of clothes or politics they admired. So I did essentially reinvent myself, but I think as you become older and as you really want to understand your identity, I think it's important to really go back to the place where you grew up in order to really understand yourself.
So did you start telling friends these stories?
Yes.
Were they surprised? Because
yes.
Because even though you had that drug period, you've always been the good girl who did what she was told. You
Absolutely.
Were the achiever in school as well. I guess that was your way of escaping
and
shocked. Putting some structure into your life.
A lot of my friends were very, very shocked. And even when I was going through the period of addiction, I would go out with a lot of people and we would just go out for drinks and they would leave and then it would get much worse later on and they wouldn't see that. So for the great portion of my life, I pretty much concealed not only my addiction, but my upbringing. And when I began to tell people, they were shocked. But some of my friends came back to me and said, well, this explains a lot. This explains a lot of our arguments and who you are and how you built up a wall that we couldn't get through as your friend. So I think for a lot of people in my life, although they were surprised, it was gratifying because they had a deeper understanding of me and we can have a sort of a friendship that operated on the basis of honesty.
So obviously you wrote this memoir for all sorts of reasons, but one of them could be that it helped you break down some of those walls.
Mm-hmm.
Because is this a form of, forgive me for
catharsis.
Positing, yeah, catharsis, doing some kind of a self-analysis, whether that was the intention or not?
That was part of the intention. I think the greater intention in writing this book, and I know this may sound sort of cliche is that this is my final conversation with her, because my mother was always louder and stronger and I was always very silent. And I think when you commit something like this to paper, when you say these are the things that happened, this is the kind of parent you were to me, this is what happened because of that relationship, I think it's a louder voice closing the conversation. So this is sort of closure for me.
What happened when you tried to talk to her about her drug use and tell her that you wanted her to stop?
She denied it.
To the end?
I would show her. I remember I would look through her things, and I found, you know, when you used to keep 35 millimeter film in those vials, mm-hmm. I would find vials of cocaine. And I'd say, I found this in your jacket. And she's like, it's not mine. I'm holding it for someone. And how do you explain her consistent behavior in keeping with how addicts are? And she just denied it to the very end.
Why the title, The Sky is Invisible from Here?
I think because much of, that's a very good question. I think for much of my life, I felt that we operated in darkness. We lived in a home where my mother demanded that the shades all be pulled down. There was no light in my house. It was all false fluorescent light. And I grew up in an area that was sort of bleak, and everyone's lives and their futures were bleak. And so the concept of sky to me is light, hope. And for the longest time, there wasn't that sort of hope. And so that I think I wrote that story from the perspective of a child, but also to look to the fact that now, as an adult, there is hope.
Now, you've written quite a bit mm-hmm. over the last few years and been anthologized and mostly nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Are you going to try fiction again?
Oh,
now?
I'm going right back to fiction. It's much, much, much more fun to make up people and characters. And I've written a great deal of fiction before my memoir, so my next book will be a novel.
Uh-huh. About similar kinds of things, or have you dealt with this and worked out the problems enough just by writing this book?
I think my next book will be focused on technology and society and how it alienates people. So I think While I think my mother or the concept of that maternal relationship will probably progress through much of my work, I think this family dynamic is sort of done with.
Just one more thing. What will happen if your mother does call you tonight and said, I heard you on the radio?
You know, I don't know. I don't think you planned for that. I think I just, hopefully I have enough tools to deal with it if it happens.
Felicia C. Sullivan's book, The Sky is Invisible from Here, Scenes from a Life, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and congratulations for this book. It's really quite moving, and anybody who grew up in Brooklyn, even people who didn't go through this, will recognize some of the things that they've experienced over their lifetimes. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.